So first of all, thank you to the organizer, Juan Denis and Hai Ching, for inviting me here. This has been a really great meeting. It's a fantastic place. And also, I enjoy very much to have a small group of people and not these massive conferences. So I've learned a lot of stuff. So I've been asked by Denis to talk about multi-messenger observations, you know, and what a kilohertz instrument could provide in this area, and also to comment on the impact that such an instrument would have on measurements specifically for the Hubble parameter. So in my head, you know, deciding exactly what to talk about, so I've decided to use, you know, this example. We have one of, you know, the kind of science we could do with multi-messenger observations, what we could have done if we have had, you know, an instrument that had a better sensitivity, let's say above 500 hertz, and what we could do if we envisage a network, I don't know, 10 years from now, where, I mean, probably we'll have between 3 and 5 instruments operating at better than LIGO design sensitivity. What happens if at least one of those could be tuned specifically at high frequencies? So that's what I had in my mind. I also, well, I'll make some comments later on about cosmology and H-naught measurements. Okay, so I think it was great to detect the first gravitational wave just from binary black holes. You know, this was just an observation from with, if you want, gravitational wave telescopes. However, I think it's sobering to try to think about what we could have done with the observation of 17817 if we have had only the gravitational wave data. So no electromagnetic counterpart. And so this, and assuming that you know, we couldn't place any meaningful limits on radiation from, I don't know, gamma ray bursts or kilonova, et cetera. So this is the boring summary table that we worked on so hard in LIGO. This is the updated one that has just been posted on the archive at the beginning of last week, with all the you know, key parameters. So the first thing is the masses, okay, that we learn from gravitational wave observations. So this is the M1, M2 plot. I think everybody now is very familiar with the fact that we actually measure, well, one mass parameter, this particular combination, which is the chirp mass to, you know, almost 0.1%, the 0.1% level. We have the second mass parameter is not terribly well constrained. This is reflected in the fact that we have sufficiently large error bars on the individual masses. And if you put this, you know, plot into the context of what are the, what we know about binary neutron stars, or neutron stars that we observe, you know, in with radio pulsars or from X-rays. I mean, this is, I've drawn this in PowerPoint, okay? So this is just a very bog standard binary neutron star. It's not the most massive one, it's not the least massive one. It's, you know, it falls nicely in the middle, and so no big surprise over there. So the other things that we may want to do is say something about the spins. And you know, we've had endless discussions about what we can say about the spins. You know, the punchline is that we measure it very poorly, in particular if we have some, if we have compact objects that are slowly spinning, you know, in terms of Kerr parameter, as it is the case for binary neutron stars. In fact, we just put, you know, almost meaningless limits on the spins. So we learn nothing about the spins. The final thing is, of course, to measure this, you know, famous now tidal deformability parameter, or what I think nuclear physicists call the polarizability parameter. And again, I mean, if you look at the gravitational data, gravitational wave data alone, we cannot exclude that this guy is zero. Okay, so formally, you know, we cannot even say, well, with high confidence that we had two binary neutron stars. I mean, great observation, fantastic, but that's where we stop. Okay, the situation, okay, so a lot of the phenomenal, exciting science came from bringing together, you know, data from one specific telescope with everything else. And when you have matter involved, which is, I think, what we have in our head when we talk about, you know, how high-frequency instruments, this is, I think, is really useful to consider that in the into the context of, you know, multi-messenger observations. So I have to put this, you know, summary plot here because we spent so much time arguing about this plot when we were putting together the multi-messenger astronomy paper in LIGO. You are not supposed to be able to read it, and I think the message is that it's very, very crowded. Okay? So we have gravitational wave data, we have, of course, the gamma rays data, we have this whole set of optical near-infrared data that first identified the counterpart and then all the follow-up observations, and I'll talk about this a little bit, that allowed us to study, you know, the spectra, the emissions from the kilonova and the ambient galaxy in which this guy was sitting. We have then at later times the X-ray, the Chandra observations, and in the longer terms down here, the radio. And I think everybody knows this, but the monitoring campaign of the remnant of this object is still ongoing. Okay, we discussed a bit this possible claim of a flare about 5 months in X-ray, about 5 months after the merger. Well, we'll have to see the paper and see how robust or reliable that conclusion is. However, the long-term, monitoring is really done in radio. This is one of the papers that have recently appeared. And, you know, this is about 5 to 6 months, 160, 151 plus or minus two or so days after the merger. And the important point here is that it seems that now the flux is starting to turn over and dim. And of course, we can't see any more in the optical infrared, etc., near infrared, etc. Okay. So just to give a summary, I mean, this is known. This gives me also offer the possibility, considering that a lot of things have already been mentioned here, to just insert some random, you know, fill some gaps. So this is a sort of summary of what is the scope of the science that has been done. Okay, of course we've done a lot of astronomy. And if you want, relativistic astrophysics with this guy. But a lot of this was really driven by the fact that we saw, for example, the gamma ray burst just after, you know, 1.7 seconds after the merger, and then we could study in the optical near-infrared, you know, the emission from the kilonova. This also branches out into fundamental physics and cosmology. I mean, it's phenomenal that just by measuring this time difference between the gamma ray and the gravitational wave, 1.7 seconds, over a baseline of 400 megaparsec, 140 or so light years, a million light years, then we could put a limit on the fractional difference of propagation of light and gravitation waves of 1 part in 10 to the 15. And and this, for example, have a lot of consequences for cosmology. In fact, you may have noticed just after the announcement of the detection, many, many papers were published, from the cosmology crowd about how many models that, you know, alternative theories, extension of beyond general relativity, that would you know, predict a difference between the propagation of the two signals were essentially ruled out. And so some person may be particularly aggressive and say that, for example, this has killed completely the Euclid mission that is going to fly, you know, in a couple of years. I don't want to take that view. But, you know, that was one of the key science goal of that mission, which is a cosmology mission, to try to disentangle between, you know, dark energy and, you know, deviation from GR, and the kind of model people had in mind were indeed models that would predict this difference of speed of propagation, and this is completely out of the window now. Then, of course, we'll talk about cosmology in a second. I like a lot, you know, the nuclear physics angles, and the first day we heard already many talks about the connection there, and this was indeed, I mean, a lot of this work was made possible by combining the gravitation wave data with the observations that we had of the remnant. So I will mention one paper that has not been mentioned so far, and I like this paper because it connects directly, you know, the astronomy observations with nuclear physics experiment. So this is one of this plot that, for example, were shown yesterday on the tidal deformability parameter. So gravitational waves tell you that the compact objects needs to be, I don't know, with a radius of about 14 kilometers or smaller. We've heard how we can use other information in order to bound from below this radius. And this is related to the equation of state. The equation of state is also, as ingredient, contains this symmetry energy. Symmetry energy is also reflected in the skin radius of neutrons that is computed through nuclear physics experiments. And is useful to compare the scales. So the scale up here is the neutron skin for lead 208. This is in femtometer, and this is, you know, about 0.1, 0.3 of femtometers. And so you can map this lambda parameter, this effective tidal deformability parameter for a 1.4 solar mass neutron star versus the radius of the 1.4 solar mass neutron star, and then use your equation of state to predict, you know, a line in this plot. And because we have a solid upper bound on this parameter lambda, which is about 800, we can say, well, okay, a neutron star of 1.4 solar masses would have to live at a radius which is below something like 13.7 or so kilometers. However, you can map this radius also in this neutron skin thickness. And therefore, if you take this this bound of the 90% bound, you would say that this has got to live in this rare area here on the left. Okay. However, there is one single data point of one experiment that actually puts this the measurement of the skin radius to be above this limit. Now, the problem here is that the statistical error is very large, okay? And in fact, this measurement has now motivated the fact that there will be a better experiment in order to try to reduce this measurement error. But if you take this guy at face value, and if it turns out that the value is around what has been published so far, then this, for example, would be an indication, for example, of you know, some phase transition in neutron stars. And so I think this opens up, you know.
Can you say more about what the neutron skin is physically, and also what are the blue data points?
So these blue data points are taken from numerical from modeling. Okay, so this is modeling, is essentially the equation of state of neutron star. But also you can map into so this is, if you want, the difference between the radius of a proton and of a neutron. Okay, and is therefore related to this parameter, which is the symmetry energy. Okay, and unfortunately, I do not understand sufficient. So something I've discovered is that I know very little about nuclear physics.
It's mostly the pressure that. So the slope of the symmetry energy, which correlates with the pressure of the equation of state, that determines the thickness of the neutron skin in such heavy nuclei like lead. And by measuring the charge radius and the radius of the hole, of the including the neutron skin with parity violating experiments, you can try to get an idea about this neutron skin and therefore of the pressure. And this is, of course, the pressure at saturation density. And by here, the radius of a neutron star is probably determined mostly by the pressure at maybe 2 times saturation or so.
So yeah, that's right. So this is the radius which is measured at saturation density, and is the pressure from the neutrons and protons in this lead 208. Whereas here, the pressure is provided by gravity. And if so, they are just two completely different angles to get to the same physical, the underlying physical quantity, and we will have to reconcile everything.
Why? How can you relate a neutron skin one-to-one to a neutron star radius?
So because in the, you are doing much more modeling, maybe you want to answer this?
It's again the pressure. I mean, yeah. The radius of a neutron star, it scales very tightly with the pressure at 2 times nuclear density, right? And this neutron skin scales tightly with the radius also at saturation at nuclear density approximately. Therefore these two quantities are correlated.
I'm confused. What is the, is it, but it's referenced to lead just because that's what people do experiments?
That's the experimental, yes. Absolutely.
You could use any other nucleus.
I see, okay. Thanks.
Yeah, so this is the actual.
Very expensive. Yeah. I mean, right. They are really fighting a lot to get more beam time to improve these measurements. Mm. This is apparently not so easy.
Thank you.
So I think this is, we'll see how things evolve. Okay. All right, so this is just to bring in, to make the point again how, if you want, insensitive, the LIGO observations at the sensitivity at which we had in O2 was to the merger remnant. So this is a plot in frequency. Now this is linear in frequency from 1 kilohertz to about 4 kilohertz. So this is just a different way of showing something that has been shown so far. Okay, and this here on the y-axis is the amplitude spectral density. So this is the sensitivity of the instruments, at the time of 1708-17. And these are just some representative waveforms from, our range of possible merger waveforms that we could have had as a product of the merger of these neutron stars. And the blue area is the upper limit that was set by doing the LIGO, the analysis of the LIGO data, LIGO and Virgo data. in this frequency range. Now, this is a limit that is set not by doing a match filtering analysis, but is sufficiently model independent. For example, use wavelet, etc. And as you can see, you can put this loose constraints here, which is completely consistent with what you think may have happened. And it's useful to compare these constraints with what could have happened. That's interesting. I've lost the axis here. They show up on my computer. Okay, this is not good. Okay, anyway, this is design sensitivity for advanced LIGO, and this is the high frequency kilohertz design. So essentially, in the relevant range, the sensitivity is 10 to minus 24. Okay, so if you take the ratio between these waveforms and a putative instrument at 10 to the minus 24, and you square it, you would have, roughly speaking, the signal-to-noise ratio squared at which you could have observed the signal, which is maybe roughly 10-ish. And then you take the square root, is about 3. That's optimal signal-to-noise ratio. And therefore, you probably lose another factor of a few if you do a non-optimal analysis, which therefore says that for objects of this kind, we may have had a way of extracting some information here. Okay. So I really think that the 500 to several kilohertz is the interesting region. This is where we could start to see the tidal effects, and it has been seen. Well, we cannot see the tidal. Has been said we cannot see the tidal effects, beyond 400 hertz. We cannot see the signal beyond 400 hertz. Actually, in match filtering, we can, match that signal there. You just don't see in the spectrogram. But clearly, our sensitivity is very limited. I'm losing the axis on that plot. I don't know. I also want to make another point, and I think Yanbai probably is going to say much more later, and is about neutron star disrupted by binary black holes. By a black hole. So this is an old paper by Michele Valesnieri, but I think it's a useful paper because it gives you a very good handle about the key quantities. Around. So this is a 1.4, so for a 1.4 solar mass neutron star orbiting black holes of different masses, let's say 80 solar masses, 40 solar masses, all the way down to 2.5 solar masses. And as a function of the radius of this neutron star, this is the line of the frequency of the tidal disruption of the neutron star. And these numbers, the dots here, give you the point of disruption for different values of the Kerr parameter of the black hole. And if you are to the left, you disrupt, to the right, you plunge. And so as you can see again, so LIGO has observed black holes of masses primary between roughly this line, 10 solar masses, and that line, 40 solar masses. Of course, we do not know what is the sort of masses of black holes for neutron star black hole systems, but this is a very reasonable range. And as you can see, okay, there is a dependency on the spin of the black hole. But again, this region between roughly 500 and 1.5 kilohertz, 500 hertz and 1.5 kilohertz is the place where we could actually see the disruption of a neutron star.
So this curve is the tidal disruption frequency for different neutron star radius.
And that's right. So So the tidal disruption frequency depends on the black hole spin. Okay, and you fix the mass of the neutron star to be 1.4 solar masses, and depending on the radius, which therefore depends on the equation of state. Okay, you would be disrupted at different points. And I'm sure there are millions of numerical simulations that have been done, you know, to try to do a much more refined analysis. But I think the important point here is that, again, this frequency region, 500 hertz, 1.5 kilohertz, is where, if there is a tidal disruption, the tidal disruption will take place. And if there is a tidal disruption, then, you know, we may see a flash. Okay.
Since we have so far have not seen any neutron star black holes.
Francisco had a... Yesterday you were discussing some neutron star black hole, didn't you? Okay. Anyway, no, carry on.
Yeah, I just mean... And is it possible we're just never going to see them? Like, somehow nature precludes this particular pair from forming?
I think it's consistent with what we know so far, that there are no black hole neutron star systems. But, you know, we haven't seen one. However, you know, if you take population synthesis models, they would give you also black hole neutron star systems. They are less abundant than black hole, or neutron star binaries. And there is a huge range. I actually have a plot that tells you what is the detection probability in O3. I mean, but so zero system is consistent with observational data, but I think is inconsistent with what, you know, people that do modeling. And where you are, I think it depends on who you talk to. But, you know, other people may want to comment.
Yeah, and I guess it's especially if it turns out we never have neutron stars with little black holes, then maybe the chance of seeing the tidal disruption gets extremely, extremely low. That if all we have is the neutron stars with 20 solar mass or something like that, that's
yeah,
gonna happen. But
yeah. I mean, to some extent, nobody has ever had the sensitivity really to look there.
Yeah.
And I think with O3, we are, you know, starting to go into a vaguely interesting regime. I mean, we've been surprised with, you know, the 36 and 29 solar mass binary black hole. Maybe we get surprised again. Or maybe there is nothing at the sensitivity level we have. I mean, does anybody else have a strong view on neutron star black hole?
I could say this is much more likely than many other things people in this building are studying. So,
I agree with your statement that the people who do population synthesis think we'll see some
at some point,
but before design sensitivity.
I was not surprised by 36 and 29.
I mean, I had no prior view. I really think we have, you know, an instrument to look. We should just look and be very open-minded. Okay, I think the period of second guessing is over. Okay, so let me say, so if we are doing multi-messenger observations, okay, we want to identify the counterpart. So I'll say a few things about the identification of the counterpart. So I guess I can summarize, you know, the key message with first, I mean, what really matters is the network, okay? It's not the single instrument for the identification of, you know, a counterpart. You really need to have very good angular resolution, and therefore what plays a role is to have a network of instruments that are sprinkled around the largest possible baseline you can think of, which is the Earth. And the second point is that sky area is not sufficient. I mean, we really need to have volume resolution, the three-dimensional volume for the identification of the counterpart. So you've seen this plot several times, I'm sure, but this is the sky resolution of the network, you know, the very large areas are all the black holes we've detected with only two instruments. And the two small areas, this is the binary black hole on August 14th, and this is the binary neutron star on August 17th, is when Virgo came into play. Okay. And if you add yet another instrument, that will get even better. But you are not going to change by orders of magnitude this picture. Okay. Okay, so this is the sky localization for 17, 0817, and I think it's, okay, the first thing is that we are all saying it's a small patch in the sky, okay? Well, actually, the small patch in the sky was about 30 square degrees, okay? And this is 150 times the size of the full moon. So for any, you know, optical astronomers that is doing follow-up, this is a big patch in the sky, okay? And so many, you know, we have forgotten when we talk about these things many, many times, that there was, you know, another key piece of information that we had at our disposal, and that was the distance, okay? So we had an early estimate of this distance that was placing this merger at, you know, 40 megaparsec plus or minus 10 megaparsec. And that was absolutely crucial to actually get the counterpart quickly, and for a number of reasons. Okay, so the first thing is that, okay, so this was taken from one of the papers from of the six teams that did the follow-up. So this is the SWOP telescope. So Chile had the first shot at observing, you know, the counterpart. This is the horizon, and this is the 30 degrees elevation that essentially gives you sufficiently good seeing. It was, the area in the sky was very close to this 30 degrees elevation. In fact, I mean, the effective telescope time was only 3 hours or so for all the teams that were observing this. Okay, so the strategy there, okay, this was the tiling strategy of the SWOP team, but the other teams used a very, very similar strategy, is that because it was so close, people had catalogs of galaxies that were complete, and therefore could, this is the box, is the size, is 30 arc minutes, that was covered by the SWOP telescope. And so it would have taken several days to actually go through the entire 90% or 50% error region. But actually, they could prioritize based on the galaxy they had in their catalog, and therefore the probability of hosting a binary neutron star different areas. So the strategy here was this patch, then that, 5 and 6, and then go down here. Each exposure was 1 minute, and at the 9th, they got the right place, okay? And this was possible only because the binary was so close, and because we had distance information. And so with all the instruments that we are, when we talk about building more and more sensitive instruments, and therefore detecting a gazillion of binaries, all these guys will come from the distant sources. And this strategy beyond 100 megaparsecs is just not going to work. Okay, so I think for the counterparts, really the game is in the, let's say, local universe.
Well, why can't I go in the 100 to 200 range? It seems like it's just incremental change in the catalogs.
Okay, so, right. So now the error, I'll say a few things later, but the error in the volume that you have scales as the signal-to-noise ratio to the power of 6. Okay? So if you want, you go a factor of two more distant. So let's say you lose a factor of two in a signal to noise ratio. Of course, you see much more volume. You see more system. But your volume uncertainty goes up by 2 to the 6. What is it, 64? So you lose a factor of 50. And there is one more thing. Let's see.
I guess by the time we go to 100 to 200, though, our SNR will increase. I mean, even though it's more distant, there's a, with time, there's a continuous SNR increase of detectors. So as we,
but
thinking like 2 years in the future, it's with systems that are two times better.
That's right, okay. But your error grows, your volume grows much faster.
Yeah.
Okay. And there is one more important aspect, and is the optical sky is flickering a lot. Okay, so this is the detection of from the swoop, and there are, I should say, 5 other teams that detect more or less at the same time, just to be fair to everyone. But 11 hours that they got this counterpart. But another key piece of being able to identify it quickly is that this is an image of the same patch in the sky that was taken by another team that also discovered 170817, the DL40, that was taken 20 days beforehand. And the reason is that these teams are really targeting the local universe because they are after the supernovae, okay? And therefore, they have up-to-date maps that are covering almost all sky of things that pop up. Because the supernova rate is 10 to the minus 4 per year per megaparsec cube. So if you, and as you go deeper and deeper, you have a lot of things that go off. And being able to put a distance cut, is very important. And of course, I'm not an optical astronomer, but by talking to them, they will say, well, it's going to be very hard to go beyond 100 megaparsec. Yeah, please.
And what is with all these nice surveys that will be available in a few years? I mean,
how? LSST, for example. Yeah, so everybody always talks about LSST, and in fact, it's going to be, great. So it's going to go very deep. But as you go very deep, of course, you are having a very large volume of the sky that you are going to observe. And being able to, so that if you want the false positive, go up a lot. So now there is the standard, I think, PR of LSST is that they will image essentially the entire sky every 4 days. That's the kind of stuff they say. However, for transient astronomy, this is not quite right because they revisit, they survey the sky over 4 days, but with different filters. Okay, so they will survey with the same, according to the current strategy, they will survey the whole sky with the same filter every 27 days. And over a time scale of 27 days, if you go very deep, then you have a lot of stuff that go boom. And it's very hard. It's going to be very hard to discriminate. I think nobody has looked in detail about this. I think people are trying to negotiate a different survey strategy, really driven by search for transients. But the sense I get is that the sufficiently nearby universe, which is for the sufficiently rare systems, is going to be really the place where we could do phenomenal science. And then one does, on the very large numbers, is the kind of population studies that Eric was talking about yesterday that will give you a completely different liver arm on understanding things. Okay. Right, so I better talk about H0. This is just to, okay, the fact that people could observe these things early on, and this is the very quick evolution of this kilonova, is very different from typical evolution of light curves from the typical contaminant, which are the supernova, and therefore being able to see it early on allow you to discriminate these things. And I have, okay. So I should say something about H naught. Okay. So I'm on record here. So I should clarify that I don't, okay. People are now talking about this major crisis in cosmology. Okay. And there are cosmologists here in the room, and they should comment because of this measurement of H naught. They do not agree. As I said yesterday, you know, when I was in graduate school, you know, H naught was either 50 or 100, and each team was really swearing that, you know, their results were right, and now everybody has converged around 70. So I think it's things will. I'm sure people will understand better the systematic errors. And we will converge on some number. However, it costs us nothing, you know, to actually do this measurement of H naught. And so we should just do it. Okay. Okay, so this is actually a trivial exercise. Okay, so this is, if you want to measure H naught, you measure the recession velocity, and you measure the luminosity distance, and then you solve this equation. Okay. And so this is the Hubble plot that we have in textbooks in 1929. Okay, and the scale here is 2 megaparsec. And this is the Hubble plot a la LIGO, Virgo, and the electromagnetic observers, of 2017. I mean, the usual problem in without gravitational waves is that there are essentially two schemes. Either you take the CMB maps and do your fit that depends on all the different cosmological parameters, and you extract therefore H naught, or you use some, for example, supernovae. You measure the redshift. You have an independent way of measuring the luminosity distance, and then you get H naught. If you have gravitational waves in the game, okay. If you get the redshift, therefore the Hubble recession velocity here. From electromagnetic observation, and you get a direct measurement of the luminosity distance on the other side from gravitational waves, then you solve for H naught. Now, this is not, so the idea goes back to Bernard Schütz, 1986. At that point, Bernard wasn't thinking about having both redshift and luminosity distance information, and was thinking about a sort of statistical approach, where you have possible host galaxies that you could associate the environment in which the binary sits, and therefore you would try all the possible redshifts. And this is something that we're going to do. Okay, so what limits this measurement from the gravitational wave side? Well, so this is a two-dimensional posterior density function plot in the plane of H naught, or distance, versus what is the inclination angle of your binary. The problem is that in gravitational waves, the distance and the viewing angle of the binary are correlated. So you can have, for a given amplitude that you receive, you can place a binary sufficiently distant if it is face on, and if you can bring it closer, maintaining the same amplitude you measure, you just tilt the viewing angle. And so, and you see that we have this very, very long area that gives you, you know, this very large correlations. And the distance measurement is not terribly good. Roughly speaking, goes as 1 over the signal to noise ratio. Okay, so sort of a measurement in the 10 or 20 of signal to noise ratio gives you, you know, a 10% or so answering in the distance. which is not good enough if you want to measure the hub or resolve this major crisis in cosmology between these two measurements, 68 or 73, plus or minus roughly 1 kilometer per second per megaparsec. Okay? So if you want to say something meaningful, you need to do much better. So this is our measurement of the Hubble parameter. It ranges, across what was possible 20 years ago, between 50 and 100 and something. I really think it's a proof of principle. I mean, it's phenomenal, it works. It really says, nothing about this 2.4 or 2.5% tension between these two measurements. So what is the way of making some progress there? And does a kilohertz instrument, is a kilohertz instrument going to help in any way? So the punchline is that a kilohertz instrument is not going to help in any way, but it doesn't hurt, okay? So you can really, you go down all you can to make your noise floor as low as possible in this region, 500 hertz to 5 kilohertz, whatever it is. This is not going to help on H naught, but you can do equally well there with other designs, okay? And you go after all the other signs, yeah.
Alberto, we started a chat yesterday about whether or not the Jocelyn Reed, Chris Messenger, tidal measurement maybe could change that. Are you?
Yeah, so I think we should sit down and do a simple order of magnitude calculation. I was doing it in my head and was last night and was too lazy to actually scribble on a piece of paper. I think it's not going to help, but I think we can.
The intuition is that still won't.
I think that won't.
Right. So how many of these, let's say, bi-neutron star mergers do we see optical counterpart?
Let me get there. Okay. So in the interest of time, I'll skip. There is this problem about this degeneracy of the viewing angle and the distance. And actually, as we are talking about multi-messenger observations, this is very, very much related to what happened when there was the merger. Okay, why we're seeing such a dim GRB the different components in the kilonova. And it a lot depends on whether we were looking at the, merger down the barrel, whether we were looking at an angle. As for the record, there is now a solid limit of a viewing angle, which is at least 13 degrees. And, I think most of...
Where does that come from?
So this is, it comes from, this is our updated LIGO plot, but actually, so this comes from the Finstead et al. Analysis, Duncan Brown, Ido Berger, etc. So what you do, you have your distance and viewing angle iota plot, and you have your error ellipse, that I showed before.
So the specific question I have is that we can't, in LIGO data alone, you can't rule out perfect alignment as long as you are sensible in your construction of your confidence interval and that you look at cosine iota rather than iota. So when you look at iota and construct your posterior there, you automatically always exclude zero. Is this...
No. This is bringing in an extra piece of information.
Extra thing that's happening.
Yeah. The extra piece of information is that instead of getting the distance from the gravitational waves, we actually know what the Olds galaxy is. And you see...
But our paper, we included that in the...
No. But there is, subsequently, there is this measurement of the distance through what is called surface brightness, which seems to be particularly reliable, So instead of having a sufficiently large let's say, distance uncertainty, then you can cut. You really, this is 40 plus or minus 1.5 or so, Cantiello et al. And other people. Okay, and therefore, now you have reduced your uncertainties on the viewing angle.
Is your sense that that's distance determination is reliable?
Yeah, everything is. I mean, we can discuss about, you know, nitty-gritty details, but it's fine. And we haven't used it because of the politics, okay? I mean, this was around, but you know how it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, but it's fine. Okay, it's, so, and I think, you know, people say, well, it's about 20 degrees viewing angle.
So I'm just looking at this paper by Duncan Brown's group and friends. It looks like they're constructing their confidence intervals with iota, not cosine iota. Are you sure that they're not just seeing a...
No. I think they've done the analysis. I mean, I haven't studied to death. We can look at it in more detail.
Okay, we'll grab it.
But it's fine. I think it's fine. Okay. So this is, I think this is the important plot. Okay, so if you want to measure accurately this guy, okay, this is the relative error in the Hubble parameter, we want 1%, roughly speaking, really to make a difference. Okay, we have two sources of errors. The first is what we talked about already, is the determination in the distance. Okay, this is the relative error on the distance which comes from gravitational wave observations. And at current sensitivity at about 40 megaparsec is about 15%, signal-to-noise ratio of 30 or so. Okay? And this scales as 1 over the distance. So as you go for a given sensitivity, as you go further and further away, that error here increases. Okay, so you want to be close. Okay, close is a much smaller error here. It also means fewer binaries. Okay, because you look at smaller point. Okay, so one problem is fewer binaries, but there is another problem. And the other problem is that if you get too close, then your recession velocity will come from two parts. One is the Hubble flow, but the other one is the peculiar velocities. And the peculiar velocities, of course, their contribution grows as you get closer. And so these two guys, just for sort of magic, are more or less around the same order of magnitude, which is about 10%, between 30 and 50 megaparsecs. Okay, so you are stuck, okay, with this sort of measurement, which is at the 10-ish, maybe more percent level, at near universe. And if you want to make any major gain, then you need to observe a lot of these guys. And then you win, statistically, like the square root of the number of systems that you observe. So this is just, a measurement of the dispersion velocity in the galaxy that was the host galaxy of 1708-17, and dispersion velocity is around 200 kilometers per second.
In the future, we will have better detector sensitivity, so we have better distance measurement. So you can shift this to larger distances.
That's right. We can shift it to larger distances, and therefore, we can make the contribution from the peculiar velocities less painful. However, shifting to larger distances keeps, roughly speaking, what is your error in the distance determination from gravitational waves, roughly constant to the one that we have right now. And therefore, you have this, you need to get from the 20% or so level down to the 1% is an order of magnitude, which means 100 binary neutron stars. I mean, it's going to happen. And if you take, okay, so I'll need to wrap up, I guess. So if you take Dan Holt's group, there is a similar paper by Finney, Tal, you know, the CCA group, and other collaborators. How long, so this is the fractional error on the measurement of H naught. This is the magical line, okay? This is the 1%. These are different assumptions. You know, this is binary neutron star with some sort of counterparts. You need to get into the hundreds, maybe more, with counterparts that you have identified. And so, and then they make a guess about what is the sort of network that probably will give you this, this sort of numbers, well, 2025. You want the two LIGOs plus India, and then hopefully Japan is also working with Virgo, and maybe you were gonna get to that point. Okay.
It's not enough just to have Virgo?
Yes, I think Virgo is gonna be sufficient.
Three yeah. should be enough.
I think, yeah, I mean, after that, I mean, you do not gain any more dramatically. So in terms of, okay, so problems using many more sources, so going deeper, is, okay, of course that if you start to look at, you know, significant redshifts, you have the problem that you are not going to fit only for the Hubble parameter, but you have to start to include all the other cosmological parameters. The other thing is by the time you get to 0.11 in redshift, and this is very relevant for all the studies that people were doing, for example, for you know the Cosmic Explorer Einstein Telescope, where we have a million neutron star binaries or so, then you have weak lensing as well. And you need to correct, well, correct. Weak lensing is going to smear your measurement.
Albert?
Yeah.
You probably said this and I just missed it, but what's the difference here between a BNS and a golden BNS?
Okay, the golden BNS is a binary neutron star which is sufficiently close that is therefore in the 50 or so megaparsec region where you can have you can identify a sufficiently small volume and therefore a sufficiently small number of galaxies that could be associated as a host. And if there is the counterpart, you actually see the redshift straight away. And there are all sorts of assumptions which we can discuss.
The difference between golden BNS and BNS in terms of observation or data analysis is that in one you definitely have a clear association with the galaxy,
yeah.
And the other it's a statistical association.
That's right.
With any possible.
Exactly. And okay, so you were mentioning yesterday completeness of catalogs. Again, I'm not an expert in completeness of catalogs. We are using this Clade catalog that should be you know complete up to 73 megaparsecs, I think the chances of having complete catalogs beyond 100 megaparsecs is very slim. So to finish, okay, so I computed a quick and dirty figure of merit for sky localization. And so this comes from the standard work is essentially Fisher information matrix sort of analysis and to leading order what determines your sky localization is your timing accuracy and then of course the number of detectors and so this is work that Steve Ferrest did that we improved and so on but so I've taken advanced LIGO design sensitivity so advanced LIGO design sensitivity, so the effective bandwidth is then translated into the timing error, okay, about 0.15 milliseconds. If you take the kilohertz the MIME, I think we should, from the surnames of the three authors of the paper, okay, instrument. So what you do is that for a system at the same distance, okay, well, the bandwidth is slightly larger, because of course you have more high frequency sensitivity. However, there is a weighted bandwidth where you weight by also the fact that the power goes as f to the minus 7/3 in gravitational waves. You gain about a factor of 3 in SNR, and essentially the SNR gain is reflected into the timing error. Okay, so as long as you do not screw up in your design too much the low frequency, which is what gives you the SNR gain, you know, you will, you know, every calculation we've done for advanced LIGO, et cetera, will stay the same. And we just gain as the square of the signal to noise ratio gain. And ET has got a big improvement, but not because of the bandwidth. It's just that is the noise floor is a factor of 10 down, okay? And so, okay, so this is the final point. The volume uncertainties goes as the signal to noise ratio, the 1 over the signal to noise ratio to the 6th. This is a study we did on binary neutron stars. Look only at this line here. So this is a fraction of events. So this is the 90% credible volume in megaparsec cubed for a number of injection of binary neutron stars in what is now going to be representative of O3 sensitivity. And this is the search volume, meaning what is the volume that contains the actual place of the where the system is. And you can see that you have 50% or so of the events within a volume of 10 to the 5 megaparsec cubed. Now you may wonder how big is 10 to the 5 megaparsec cubed. Well, you have one L star galaxy, let's say one Milky Way sort of galaxy, typical one, every 100 megaparsec cubed. And so you will really have, you know, about 1,000, just looking at this, possible host for every, if you do not have any signature of a counterpart, for every event we detect. So the nearby guys are the important ones. And I'll wrap up here. So I think there is a lot of phenomenal science you can do with multi-messenger stuff. And the nearby sources are going to be really the great one to study. So as long as you keep this frequency band open without compromising too much the low frequency component, I think it's great. Okay, I'll stop here.
Any more quick questions for Alberto?
I wonder about this self-calibrating thing that Eric mentioned yesterday, that the tides give you this sort of self, somewhat tell you the scale themselves. In this case, doesn't this give us an extra handle on this radial direction and shrink the volume?
So, okay, but the errors, the typical errors that you were getting by assuming you know perfectly well the equation of state, which we may at some point, I don't know, there may be a... So the delta Z over Z was of the order of a few, is that right? Larger than one, okay? And therefore, okay, just...
Yeah, maybe I think I missed it from yesterday, why so large?
Well, because, okay, no, you guys should comment.
Basically, if we measured it to a kilohertz, don't we see from 500 to a kilohertz, we see all this tidal stuff, so.
Well, for advanced LIGO, it was above one, but for the high frequency detector, it was not that large.
I think it's still 10% or something.
Yeah.
Pardon?
10% error on Z for the high frequency detector. But then if you have 100,000 of them or something like this.
What's the Z in your story? Are you talking about redshift or this?
Redshift.
Okay.
So you convert the measurement into redshift.
But if you have, so let's say that we have an ET and a high frequency detector both. So we can see 100,000 BNS per year with ET, and for some of these we can get some high frequency measurement of the tides. So if you take our 10% number divided by the square root of 10 to the 5, you would get like...
Okay, but for the one for which you see the high frequency measurement of the tides, those are the local ones.
Well,
I think this plot tells you, I mean...
So that's like tens of megaparsecs.
Tens, absolutely.
All right, so our rate of that distance is not going to be...
I mean, I think this is the plot that tells you. So this is at 40 megaparsec. The high frequency detector is about 10 to the minus 24. It's very consistent with the results that you showed yesterday. And therefore, okay, I mean, we can argue about this.
So we might get a factor of, let's say we get 100 events. So then we can reduce the square root of that's 10. So we can take our Z error on 1 is 10% divided by 10. So maybe we can get down to 1%.
Okay, but all this, yeah. But I mean, the number of these systems, I mean, you will be dominated by the distance systems. I don't remember exactly what is the range or the horizon distance for Einstein telescope, but it's redshift 2-ish.
I'm just saying, let's say we have 100 events and at tens of megaparsecs.
Oh yeah, but that you, an 100 of events where you see the counterpart and where...
You don't need to see the counterpart. That's the point of seeing the tides.
Yeah, well,
but if,
that's actually also my question, like, what's the chance of seeing the optical counterpart?
We would want to see the optical counterpart for a bunch of them to confirm the tidal method. But then after that, we can ditch the optical counterpart and do it all based on tides.
Yeah, could you go back to your slide with the error for neutron stars with counterpart and without counterpart?
I mean, if we see the optical counterpart, it's going to give us better redshift measurement anyway for individual measurement, right?
Yeah, but
the question is, what's the chance?
So this is the, you know, this is the counterpart.
Yeah, so what is, so if you multiply this by the chance of seeing a counterpart, then how does green and blue compare?
So the for every one without counterpart, you see something like, 50 without counterpart.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
So then you need to, some sense, multiply green by 50 to for a fair comparison in terms of time.
Why so bad? What are you talking about? Are you talking about this prompt gamma ray burst?
No. I'm not counting on gamma ray bursts because for gamma ray bursts, who knows about the beaming and this is about identifying a host galaxy, okay, and therefore a counterpart.
Yeah, okay.
Again, the probability
megaparsec thing happened to be not really pointed at us, so we got this dim electromagnetic thing.
Yeah, I think we'll see. I mean, just with the kilonova, we'll see the counterpart anyway.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But you see, at one, so we've seen it one in 1 year. Just okay. Of 01. Okay.
2017 was an unlucky year.
Okay, well, I mean, we have a factor of 20 or so to play with the event rate.
Yes.
Okay, we could have seen 20. If we had seen 20 within that range, we would be around here. I mean, I think we can, if we decide exactly what are the assumptions, we can actually spell out these numbers rigorously and not, hand-waving. With some simplifications, but I think we can really do that.
Sounds like there's a lot for discussion in the afternoon, but maybe we should move on to the next part.
Okay.